Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are joining us from. Welcome to today's webinar on the subject of R2v3, Lessons Learned and Common NCRs. My name is Austin Matthews. I am the EHS Program Manager with Perry Johnson Registrars. Again, welcome. I have an agenda on this slide. We will cover very briefly some housekeeping items, introduce Perry Johnson Registrars, who we are, what we do, highlight some of the benefits of certification, and then we will spend the majority of the time on some of the more common NCRs we're seeing as we're conducting our R2v3 audits, some of the things that we have learned over the course of the last couple years of auditing the standard. I'll close with an overview of the certification process for anyone who is interested or considering initial certification, so you can understand what that process looks like. I would say probably the majority of people in attendance today are already certified to R2v3, and they're interested in some of these common NCRs and lessons learned to help their next audit go as smoothly as possible. But for anyone who is considering initial certification and on the fence, some of the primary benefits of certification include that commitment to responsible reuse and recycling of electronics and components that the standard represents at its core, driving improvement to an organization's environmental health and safety performance by implementing and maintaining the requirements of the standard. The standard provides a framework for meeting customer and/or regulatory requirements, again, by implementing and maintaining the requirements of the standard. Certification can drive increases or improvement in areas such as management commitment and employee engagement, can provide a competitive advantage or improved public image, being able to advertise that certification. Other financial benefits vary by area, by industry, a number of other factors. We have seen occasionally an insurance company offer a premium discount, for example, for maintaining certain types of standard certifications. Can help achieve strategic objectives and/or stakeholder requirements, and the ability to integrate the management system with other business management systems or standard certifications. So without further ado, let's dig into the main talking points for this standard, or excuse me, this webinar. We're going to cover, as I mentioned, some of the most common NCRs we've seen so far. These aren't in any particular order. This isn't starting with the most frequent and working our way down to the least frequent. I kind of went through in order of the appendices and then the process requirements, give or take a few. So some of the most common NCRs that we've seen since we started auditing R2v3 and analyzing the trends of all of the NCR data we collect every time an audit is conducted, we do see a common source of NCR would be Appendix A, the downstream due diligence or downstream management process requirement. Some examples of NCRs we commonly see against Appendix A requirements, because there are a lot of requirements in each appendix, could be incomplete records of due diligence, could be incorrectly identifying a downstream vendor that is not certified to R2v3 as a downstream vendor that's certified to R2v3, which, if you're familiar with the standard, means there is a deficit for the amount of due diligence that was expected to be performed versus what was actually performed. If you thought your tier one vendor was certified to R2v3 and they're not, again, there creates a deficit in the due diligence requirements. Verifying the downstream vendors meet applicable appendix requirements as relevant. This is another common area. If you are relying on a downstream vendor to fulfill some of the other process requirements on your behalf, such as physical data sanitization or repair activities, have you verified the downstream vendor meets those applicable appendix requirements in addition to the more generic or more general downstream due diligence expectations? Another requirement we see NCRs written against commonly in Appendix A is the need for pollution liability insurance for organizations that process negative value equipment. There would have to be a complete lack of negative value equipment to justify not maintaining pollution liability insurance. A waiver or a letter from a competent authority no longer suffices. Moving on to Appendix B, there are, again, so many requirements within the appendix. I have made some generalizations here. We often see findings in, most often I should say, in one of two categories, that the process is not meeting the requirements, whether it's implementation or maybe some pieces are missing, or the documentation of the expectations is incomplete. So maybe the procedures or the plan doesn't meet all of the requirements of the standard. Some examples, the need to use software for logical sanitization, maintaining video recordings, meeting the destruction expectations by utilizing a method or a type of physical destruction found in Appendix B, Table 1, utilizing unique identifiers, making sure the data sanitization plan covers all of the required elements, ensuring the training and competency requirements are met. There are, again, just to summarize, a lot of different requirements in Appendix B, and we write findings against a number of the sub-requirements. Some clients don't qualify for Appendix B at all, in which case you wouldn't receive a finding against Appendix B. But if you do qualify for Appendix B, you could be qualifying for logical sanitization or physical sanitization or both. And that would impact the expectations, you know, what is relevant for the process versus what perhaps would be being conducted by a downstream vendor instead. So for Appendix B, we're making sure the documented plan meets all of the standard requirements. You've got Core 7 and Appendix B to account for in your documented plan, making sure the process is implemented to adhere to all of those requirements, and that we've connected all the dots if there are any portions of data sanitization or data security that you are not conducting in-house but are relying on a downstream vendor to conduct for you. For Appendix C, a common source of NCR, again, could look like processes not meeting the requirements of the standard or the documented plan not meeting all of the expectations or requirements, not checking all of those boxes. Again, we see a lot of requirements within the appendix as far as categorizing and testing and having quality assurance plans, return policies, utilizing software, maintaining records, accounting for all relevant media types. So not only do you want to make sure the reuse plan, if you are qualifying for Appendix C, checks all of the boxes, hits all the points that are spelled out in Appendix C, but also that the implementation follows Core 6 and Appendix C requirements to account for all functionalities of all media types to be adequately tested and recorded. Core requirement one, some of the most common NCRs we see for core requirement one include failing to incorporate all relevant pieces within the certification. That could be including all the relevant names. Are there other business names or entity names or DBAs being utilized that are relevant to certification but weren't included within the scope of the audit or the contract? Are there relevant sites or locations that need to be included in the certification and were not included? Does the scope include all of the relevant activities at all of the relevant locations, all types of electronics being processed, and does the scope meet the code of practice requirements? Core requirement three contains an expectation for organizations to assess risk, to evaluate the potential for exposures to certain hazardous substances that can be commonly found in different types of electronics. So depending on the types of electronics processed by a facility and the processing methodologies used, that risk of exposure for employees or relevant workers could be higher or greater than other locations who perhaps process less hazardous equipment or process it to a lesser extent, so the exposure risk is lower. The intent in core requirement three is not about how the exposure results or those assessment results are controlled or acted upon, but how they are assessed, whether the organization is considering them, assessing the risk appropriately, to then address those risks further down in the standard. Since this wasn't specifically included in R2 2013, and it looks a little bit different, perhaps, than the requirements for ISO 14001 or some of the common environmental or health and safety standard certifications we see commonly paired with R2 V3. This is something a little bit different, something a little bit new. So this is a common source of NCR. Perhaps an assumption was made was that the risk assessment that was already in place met the requirements. And I'm not saying in no situation could they meet the requirements, but because this wasn't in R2 2013, it is a new requirement. It should be reassessed to ascertain whether the current process meets the requirements or if more is needed. So that isn't always conducted. And this is a common source of NCR for R2 V3. We're not looking for something that just indicates there is no risk. We want to see how it was assessed by the organization. What types of electronics are you processing? How are you processing it? To understand the likelihood that those hazardous substances could be exposed for your employees, and then go from there. A common source of NCR for core requirement five, I would say, would be gaps in the summary of transaction expectations. For R2 V3, the expectation is really that all inbound and outbound transactions are accounted for in a detailed and accurate manner. And that's a really simplified way of summarizing core requirement five, but being able to pull a sample during an audit and not account for it in the summary of transactions, or have a disconnect between the inbound and outbound and wondering where the rest of that material is going, Those are significant concerns that don't meet the requirements of core requirement 5 in R2v3. For core requirement 6, we'll see some overlap with some of what we discussed for Appendix C, but here we might find NCRs for insufficient processes. So maybe the implementation isn't meeting the requirements of the standard, or the documentation itself isn't meeting all of the standard requirements. We're looking for the appropriateness of categorization, the existence of categorization in the first place, those records, those test records to be available, to be accurate, to be complete, to be detailed, whether the sorting for subsequent processing meets the requirements of Core 6. There's sort of a flow there if you follow Core 6 from start to finish, how things are supposed to be sorted and categorized and processed. Whether the rec categories are utilized or there's a cross-reference, that incorporation or adherence to those expectations in R2v3, conducting sampling where it's required, depending on the status of the upstream and what's been conducted and what type of evaluation is happening when it's received. Those are some examples for core requirement 6 and those common NCRs that we see. Core 6 has a lot of requirements in it, as I mentioned in the case of the appendices as well. So that is a common source of NCR. There's a lot of meat to that core requirement, where a lot of the intent of the standard lies to make sure that material is directed for processing in a manner that meets the full intent of the standard. We also see NCRs written against core requirement 7. You might see some overlap here with what we discussed for Appendix B. However, all clients are subject to core requirement 6, whereas not all clients are subject to Appendix B. So in core requirement 6, again, we might see insufficiencies in the implemented process or incomplete documentation of the standard requirements within a documented plan. Whether or not you qualify for Appendix B, you're still required to adhere to core requirement 7, including maintaining a data sanitization plan. So sometimes, again, that plan, that documented plan, isn't checking all of the boxes. Training requirements are found in core requirement 7. Controlling and identifying all pre-sanitized media, media that has not been sanitized yet. Pre-sanitized in R2v3 does not mean already sanitized. It means before sanitization has taken place or before sanitization has been confirmed to have taken place, because R2v3 wants us to assume everything contains data unless we have confirmed otherwise. Acknowledgements are required. Different security requirements are found in Core 7. The need for independent audits is found in Core 7. So the documented plan needs to account for all of these things, and they all need to be implemented in a way that we can sample them during the audits to avoid NCRs against Core 7. And lastly, Core 9, a common source of NCR would be gaps in the closure plan. Lack of a financial instrument or insufficient methods for the financial instrument. So maybe you don't have one at all. Maybe you felt like you were exempt from that requirement, or you have what you thought was an acceptable financial instrument that does not meet the R2v3 expectations. Insurance coverage adequacy would be another one. So that could go hand in hand with what we discussed earlier. Negative value equipment warranting pollution insurance. Could be some confusion about whether you needed to have workers' compensation insurance or some other mechanism like that. Those are the key NCRs, of course, we see NCRs written against potentially any requirement in the standard, but this is what our data is showing so far are the most common NCRs and the trends that we wanted to share with our clients. As far as lessons learned, I have one slide on some of the things that we've learned over the last couple years that we wanted to again share with our clients. Appendix applicability has been a learning curve, I would say, for certification bodies as well as for clients. There are some guidance materials on CIRI's website, although those are not auditable. They can answer some questions, give you some guidance, for lack of a better word, to assess whether certain appendices are relevant to your organization or not. The appendices directly result in the verbiage for the scope for R2v3. There are requirements documented in the Code of Practices that correlate one for one the applicable process requirements to the verbiage that's supposed to be utilized for the scope, and then the scope would be finished off with the types of electronics that the organization processes. So appendix applicability can be a little bit tricky, but it is key to ensuring a number of requirements are met, including the audit day requirement or the audit time requirements, and resulting in an appropriate scope statement. Another learning curve for some of our clients was the need for a quality management system certification in some instances. Obviously, this was not the case in R2 2013, so a number of clients who ultimately needed to add a certified QMS did not already have one. If you are certifying or qualifying to appendices C, D, and or F, a certified quality management system is required. There are a number of standards that meet this requirement. You can find a complete list on CIRI's website. The two most common examples are ISO 9001 and RIOS. Another learning curve or significant piece of information for R2v3 are the NCR closure deadlines and expectations. These are again found in the Code of Practices, in addition to various advisories depending on the type of audit. For example, Advisory 22 is the transition plan and contains CIRI's requirements as relevant to a transition audit. That might look a little bit different than what's in the Code of Practice for the audits post-transition or not including a transition audit. There are deadlines by which the client organizations need to share acceptable corrections, root causes, NCR responses. There are deadlines for conducting revisits and providing evidence of implementation for the actions spelled out in the plan. And these documents and these deadlines also share the ramifications for not adhering to the requirements or those deadlines, which, depending on the audit type, may include suspension or the need to repeat an audit. Facility schemes, I mentioned when we talked about core requirement one, whether all of the applicable locations were included that needed to be. R2v3 and the R2v3 Code of Practices introduced new types of schemes, new names, some nuances there, different options. Those are spelled out in the Code of Practices. Each is defined with some criteria to help you understand where you fall within those expectations. Are you certifying each location alone because they don't interact enough to justify a campus situation? Do you have a group of locations that could potentially be certified under a group scheme? They are, again, new to R2v3. The names differ from perhaps the scheme options for the ISO standards or RIOS. So you'll want to review those closely. And if you're considering initial certification, review the application forms closely as well. They do replicate the code of practices table to help you see the differences between those schemes. Just like appendix applicability in the first bullet, choosing the incorrect scheme can have a significant impact on audit time. So we want to make sure we are calculating audit time appropriately before the audit takes place. Virtual audits are still possible with R2v3, but there are specific parameters. If you're familiar with the code of practices, again, you'll see the criteria spelled out within the code of practices, which types of audits are potentially allowed to be conducted in a virtual manner. Not all of the audit types for R2v3 are allowed to be virtual. Stage 2s for R2v3 are not allowed to be virtual. They must be on site. Recertification audits for R2v3 must be on site. That's post-transition. And at least one surveillance audit per cycle post-transition must be entirely on site. There are some other requirements, but those are the main ones. Fully virtual transitions are allowed if specific criteria are met, including the auditor and the EC reviewer, the package reviewer at the certification body, both having specific training with CIRI. It does increase audit time. There are a number of requirements that kick in if we do a fully virtual transition, including the need to share documents electronically in advance of the audit to ensure eligibility. And that is documented in Advisory 24. Again, I'd like to point everyone to CIRI's website and the knowledge base for the as the primary resource for R2v3 information and answers to questions that you might have. They've issued their first formal interpretation, and any future formal interpretations will also be published to the knowledge base. So ultimately, again, they are the primary source of information and any interpretations on the standard requirements. For anyone interested in initial certification, I've included a summary of that process here. Just to go through that briefly, the first steps would always be to obtain a copy of the standard to which you are interested in certification, create the documentation that would meet the standard requirements, conduct any required training, implement the standard requirements, including an internal audit, conducting an internal audit, conducting your compliance evaluation, and conducting a management review. You'll need a contract with a certification body such as PJR to conduct those audits. And in the case of R2v3, you'll need to submit any pre-qualification information that's required for the contract review, what PJR calls the contract validation. That contract review requirement comes directly from the Code of Practices. Following successful completion of the contract validation, you would complete your Stage 1 and then your Stage 2 audits, address any resulting nonconformities before a certificate can be issued. I mentioned the contract validation activity. This is an offsite activity that ranges between a quarter and a half day, depending on the type of audit you're preparing for. Stage 1 audits are primarily documentation review. Any NCs identified do need to be resolved before you can proceed to Stage 2 in the case of R2v3. For Stage 2 audits, it's a full system audit. It must be on site. Again, we mentioned that for R2v3 stage 2, they're on site. And again, any NCRs identified need to be resolved before a certificate can be issued. Once a certificate is issued, that's good for 3 years, you enter a 3-year cycle. The first 2 years of that cycle constitute surveillance audits. These can be annual or semi-annual in nature, depending on the contract. And unlike a stage two, those would be partial system audits. And again, one of those audits could potentially be virtual, but not both for R2v3. Recertification audits must be on-site for R2v3. That would be the third year of your cycle. Similar to a stage two, it would be a full system audit that would result in a new certification and restarting that 3-year audit cycle. If you haven't already typed your questions, feel free to do so now while I share my contact information on the last slide. Again, my name is Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS Program Manager with PJR. You can reach me through the main PJR number or via email. I've also included the sales department phone number if you are a prospective client interested in obtaining a quote for certification. Let me see if we have any questions before I log off. One question we have is how long it's taking for clients to receive certifications. This varies based on a number of factors, including whether there were any NCRs identified during the audit, whether there are any extenuating circumstances such as suspensions or facility moves that would, again, result in suspension and a higher priority perhaps. And of course, we have to adhere to any deadlines that SIRI has documented, within the Code of Practices or Advisory 22 for making certificate decisions. So there's a number of factors there. We try not to promise deadlines we can't adhere to, especially with how complicated and how complex these R2v3 audits have been. So I would say sometimes it can take several months to obtain a certificate. You're always welcome to reach out to the scheduler or the salesperson for them to obtain an update on your behalf and follow along with the progress. We also offer recommendation letters once an audit has been completed to show your customers or downstream vendors where you are in the process, that the audit has been conducted. The requirements in Advisory 22 allow completion of the R2v3 audit to count for R2v3 downstream vendors, not necessarily to have to wait for a copy of the certificate as long as the audit itself has been conducted. That's a great question. Thank you. Any other questions today? I'll hang on another moment in case anyone's typing. Otherwise, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sorry, I'm a little under the weather. The longer I'm talking, the more challenging it's becoming. But if you have an R2v3 audit coming up, I hope this content is helpful. Feel free to review other webinars on the subject of R2v3 or some of the other standard certifications we offer at PJR, as well as review SIRI's knowledge base website for some other content relevant to R2v3 audits. and feel free to reach out via email or phone if you have any specific questions that may be best discussed outside of the webinar format. I don't see any other questions having come through, so I am going to log off and grab a drink of water. But thank you for joining us today, and feel free to tune back into a future webinar. Have a great day.